Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live, straight from the whipping up a poetic fusion of life, love, laughter, inspiration, motivation, education, and mental stimulation. With a cherry on top, with our weekly hot topics on everyday relations, welcome to Poetic Energy Blog Talk Radio, with your host, your Poetic Energy herself, bringing the electric current with her own poetic flow, weekly featured guests, and open mic segments. She promises to keep the current and the waves live at all times. Here on Poetic Energy Blog Talk Radio.
Poetic Energy Blog Talk Radio.
The number to chime in and express yourself is 917-932-8881. That's 917-932-8881. Non-U.S. listeners, dial 1-877-218-1183. That's 1-877-218-1183.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome to the Poetic Energy Radio Show with your host, Poetic Energy. We are so excited this evening. We have a very special guest being featured on the show this evening. It's just a wonderful honor to have her on the show. She's an English teacher, novelist, poet, essayist, an inspiring screenwriter, filmmaker. And she is the founder and CEO of a nonprofit organization, People Helping People. If that wasn't enough to be on her plate, she is also the editor-in-chief of Amistad Newspaper and Publication. And what a special surprise, she is the niece of George Clinton of the Parliament Funkadelics, and she will be doing a biography and screenplay featuring her uncle and the entire family. I am so excited that she is going to be on the show this evening. Help me welcome Miss Andrea Clinton to the show. Andrea, welcome to the Poetic NG Radio Show.
Andrea?
Are you there, Andrea?
Andrea.
How are you? Are you there, Andrea? Okay, it seems that she's having some difficulties here. Let me see here.
Hello?
Good evening, Andrea. Welcome to the Poetic NG Radio Show. How are you this evening?
Fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm glad you are here as a featured guest on the Poetic NG Radio Show. What an honor it is to have you.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Yes. I am so, you know, we read all of your wonderful information, all the things that you are doing for your bio. I just want to just get really started in interviewing you because you have so much that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about you being a teacher.
Well, I'm Muslim, of course, and I'm the principal of a Muslim school as well as a high school teacher. I teach English. I do a little history. My favorite subject is world history. And actually, my favorite subject is geology and geography. So those are the subjects that I teach.
Wow, you have a lot on your plate. I love teachers because I think it's so important to be able to educate other people who need to learn. And I think that teachers are not honored enough. So tonight I honor you being a teacher and bringing knowledge to other people. Let's talk about you. You're a novelist, a poet, an essayist, and you're also aspiring to write films. Let's talk about all of this that you have going on for yourself. Tell us a little bit about your novel is Life Knows No Bounds, One Who Loves You More. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the novel is actually Life Knows No Bounds is a series, and each volume will have 5 books to them, and the first one out is volume 1, and the first book in that volume is One Who Loves You More. And it's about a girl named Elisa. The title was named after saying that her grandmother told her to always get a man who loves you more than you love him. The issue is that she's a gold digger, and, you know, she's following the generation or two before her that like to, you know, not just use men for money, but make a career out of it. And I wrote this book because I noticed a lot of the young girls were using men, and not just in the sense that we see people, you know, some people just get one man and use them or go from boyfriend, you know, to the next or whatever. But the girls nowadays seem to be, you know, they put a lot of money into their looks, and then they go out and they get these guys, you know, much older. If they're in their teens or early 20s, these guys are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, sometimes even 60s. And they use the girls for, I mean, I'm sorry, they use the men for their money by making them think that they're, you know, they're in a relationship or they're going to get something or whatever. And they keep them for about 2 to 3 months. And then they let the guys go before they have to have sex with them. But they kind of string them along, you know, as if, oh, I'm a lady, you know, I love myself, I take care of myself, I don't just jump in the bed with anyone. But meanwhile, they're letting him try to sweep them off their feet with all of these, showering them with all these gifts. And the goal really is just to, you know, be used, you know what I'm saying, or to use them, you know, to for material gain and for financial gain. And so, you know, I was seeing this going on so much, and I was asking, you know, just different people. I have cousins in Chicago, Indiana, California, and especially in the southern states. And I just started asking around, like, you know, are the girls like this down there? And they were like, yes. They said it's ridiculous, you know, when you see that. So, you know, I decided that
Why
I wanted to write.
Why do you think that is?
I just think, you know, it's just a, well, for starters, I would say for some, I think it's a lazy way out, because instead of you going to school and getting a degree and or going to getting a trade and doing something that's, you know, responsible and mature, it's easier for some people to just use their looks. Because remember in the movie, what was it, Players Ball or something, Players something with Ice Cube, with the Go-Go Girls or whatever, I think Lisa Ray was in it. And
the
Players Club. And remember when the saying that they all would pass to the next generation that would come in was, you better use what you got while you got it. I think
you remember?
And I think that that's something that that is still passing around, but just accept it's, yes, it's on the go-go dance floor, if that's what they're still calling it. And, of course, it's in the music videos, which is probably the newest, you know, go-go dance floor, and, you know, on the pole or whatever. And then, you know, of course, it's the prostitution and things like that. But I think for some girls, they feel like if they don't sleep with them and they're not a prostitute or anything like that, then, you know, it's okay. You know, they're just getting theirs. And, you know, and it's really happening a lot. It's almost like an epidemic. And they're so hidden because, you know, most people are focusing on the girls in the videos or the basketball wives or, you know, the football wives or whatever that are using the men. So these girls are kind of like hidden behind the scenes. Nobody's paying these girls any mind. And meanwhile, they're like racking up, you know.
So do you think with reading your book that men who are falling victim to young women like this, do you think that you have an audience of men who will read your book and pick up on the message that you're trying to show them, as well as the young women in the book, to change their mannerism and their approach to life? Do you think that men will also pick up on the message that you're trying to give them?
Well, I don't, honestly, at first, no. I don't think for a minute. I think what's going to happen, what I'm hoping is going to happen, of course, is that my book will begin to sell, my name will get popular, I'll be branded, and, you know, people will begin to buy my books, and then people will say, oh, what's that, or who's that, and, you know, then, you know, what I think is going to happen, is that then they're going to say, oh, what's the book about, and then some man, some guy is going to read it and going to talk. I mean, a few guys have read it, but, you know, not enough, you know, that at least not that I know of. And I think what's going to happen is over time, I think it's going to, you know, pass around like, you know, there's this book out, you know, this woman is exposing, you know, these women who do this and that or whatever. And then I think, and they're going to tell each other, you better read it, you know, because she's telling the different things they're doing. And, you know, that's what I think is going to happen. And then it's the same way Damon Amin Meadows, who is another author and a friend of mine, and he actually gave me his support with the book and actually endorsed me with a blurb on the book. He had wrote a book, again, Damon Amin Meadows, he wrote a book about exposing the men in prison who, you know, correction officers who, you know, are having families and, you know, then they're messing with the gay guys in jail and then the guys in jail who are messing around and then they're coming home with girlfriends, et cetera. And so what happened, a lot of women were like, you know, wait a minute, because, you know, as it said, a lot of black men are locked up. And so, you know, they wanted to know because a lot of women will get with these men, especially if they start trying to get themselves together and you know, get on the ball. So, you know, women began to, you know, read it, and it spread like hot, like fire. Actually, the book still sells like crazy today because, you know, those who haven't heard or either heard and haven't read it yet, they want to read and find out. And I think that same thing is going to happen with Life Knows No Bounds. I think it's going to, you know, some men are going to read it and they're going to talk and then they're going to spread it. And then just before you know it, that's what's going to happen. But the sad thing is I didn't write it to expose the women or the young girls to the men. I wrote it so that I could expose what happens or what becomes of a gold digger to the girls who are doing it. So the guys just happen to, you know, get a little benefit. They get an inside scoop. You know what I mean? They get an inside scoop. If they buy it and they read it. But I didn't buy it with the men in mind. And I did take into consideration that the men will read it and they'll know and they'll be up on it. But it's probably, it's good. It's for the better if they do because, you know, it's a two-sided coin. It'll help the young girls hopefully to see, like, you know, you're belittling yourself and this is a form of prostitution, whether you want to believe it or not. Even if you don't sleep with them, you're still selling yourself, you know. You're selling your essence and you know, what you are, the whole dream of what you and he can be. You're selling it, you know, to him. And you're selling yourself short because, you know, you're not using your mind, you're using your body. Which is really, to me, is a sign of low self-esteem as far as you, you know, a person being smart, bright, or thinking they have any intelligence. Because any time you think you have to use your looks or your body, you know, your physical to gain, you know, it just doesn't say much for your mental, you know, for your intellect.
Absolutely.
So,
thought about marketing the book in that angle as far as, have you did any panels where you kind of were able to discuss your book and the purpose behind it?
Well, I did do a panel where, I've done a couple of panels where we discussed the book and why we wrote it, but it wasn't targeted towards that kind of thing. I'm actually getting ready to get in touch with a few authors. Wahida Clark, I put an email out to her. I emailed her and heard back from her once, and she told me to drop one by her office, and I'm trying to reach back out to her again. You know, I had to get a few things done, you know, first, but I'm ready to start doing some panels so that myself and some other authors who can get out there. And, you know, I mean, if you just wrote a book, you know, that's nice and everything, but I'm trying to get those that write these books that deal with issues so that this way when we come to the panel, when we talk, we can, you know, just all discuss, you know, these issues in front of an audience of people that it will probably concern, be it them or their relatives, their children, whatever, you know, so that we can just kind of like air out some issues and be of a help. Let the books that we put out and the work that we do be of a help. And I know she has spoken to many groups because I've seen it online. And I know there's a few others that, you know, write the books and they go out and they, you know, speak. But I just think it's really important because, okay, we talked about the girls and how to benefit them. They'll get to see, especially if you read the book, you'll see inside the book, you know, a lot of people are telling Elisa, the main character, you know, that she needs to get a job and a trade and do something with herself. But if you really, like, once you really get into it, you begin to see, read about some of the other women who were gold diggers prior to her, the girls who were her mentors and then their mentors and so on. And so, you know, at different points I'm throwing out there, not too much to where there's no storyline or you're so beaten the head with why you shouldn't be a gold digger that you're not interested. I didn't do it like that. I made sure I put, it's a drama / love story with some action and some street stuff going on, some street drama and everything. And so it's like a bunch of everything all stewed into, you know, this novel.
But at the same time,
you know, there's sections where I'm plugging in, you know, what becomes of a gold digger. And it's almost like poetic because it's not just all in one spot in the beginning or the end, and it's not throughout. It just pops up where something, you'll read and you'll see where something happened, you know, to a gold digger, and it wasn't pretty. It wasn't good. you know. So, but, you know, again, I'm hoping to do some panels with some different authors where we can just kind of take some of the things from our book and discuss them and, you know, kind of attach them to issues in the streets with hopes that the girls in the audience can gain something from it.
It seems like you're very passionate about this subject matter. How, when you began writing the book, was it geared toward your own personal knowledge of someone that you knew that really truly made you want to just write this book, or just purely from observation?
Well, it ended up being from observation, but I'll tell you, initially, One Who Loves You More, actually, that wasn't even the title at the time, but initially when I began to write this story, it was about women who like playing with men's mind, because usually it's the reverse. You get the men who try, they're mental pimps. Even though they're not actually pimps, they have that pimp mentality, and they use women for money. But, oh, I mean, I'm sorry. See, I'm so caught up in the using for money. They play with the women's mind to get what they want, to manipulate her. You know, I think it does something for the ego. But what we don't see is a lot is the women who like playing mind games with men, and it's some kind of fulfilling something that they get out of. And it's not, it may not be a whole lot of women who like to do that, but there is a nice, you know, amount. And I know a lot of them, and I know some. I call one of them, I call the queen. I won't say who she is because she'll kill me, but one of them I call the queen because since I was young, and she's been older than me, and I took her as a mentor, but I knew where to stop because I knew, you know, it was funny to laugh at and to say, you know, girl, one day some man's going to kill you, but it wasn't funny enough for me to follow in those footsteps. And, you know, I looked at all of that, and I was going to start writing about that, you know, women playing with men, you know, playing with their mind, you know, playing games. It was basically, you know how some women, and it's sad, they can't tell that a man loves them until he's either hitting them or yelling at them or snatching them up or just doing something like that or showing some kind of rough emotion. Then they feel like, okay, now I know he loves me. And it was that type of thing that I was going for with the book. But then in the course of writing and trying to keep my eyes open to, you know, women who play mind games with men, I began to see this other thing, you know, the women using men for money. And I saw it so much more than the women who like playing mind games with men, that I had to take that direction, because if not, I would have been, you know, addressing a small issue, or issue that is still big. It's a lot of women that like, you know, messing with men's head. But the bigger issue right now was the youth running out there and using men for money. So that's how this all came about.
Now, I'm so glad that you wrote us a book like this, and because perhaps, you know, in reading it, it will be able to, you know, help some young women come into the realization that they need to, you know, change their path to life, and hopefully they can be inspired to do that by reading your book. But I want to touch on so many, you have so many things that you're doing.
I know, and it's just funny because that's just me. That's like, if you want to know the ingredients of Andrea Clinton, that is me. I'm so complex. I have so many thoughts and so many things going through my mind, so many things I want to do, and it's not enough time, and of course it's not enough capital, but there's, you know, so many things that I want to do and incorporate, and sometimes it looks a little crazy. Looks a little complex, and
well,
it is.
I can tell that you're a very hungry person and that you're going to do exactly what you want to do. So I know that because you're doing so much right now. Let's talk a little bit about the poet side of you.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start writing poetry?
Probably since I was young. You know, I came up with the hip-hop generation, so, you know, I was rapping like the best of them. But I was a little shy, so I would write and keep it to myself. Or I would write if I knew somebody was going to a show or something like that, I would write it. Or if they did beats and they, you know, rapped or rhymed or whatever, I would say, let me hear the beat, and then I would write the rhyme and say, all right, go with that. Or if they started it, I might jump in and help them and say, nah, that's whack. Get that out of here. You know, do it like this. Do it like that. So that's how,
so
you know.
So are you into freestyling?
No, actually, I don't do any of that. I mean, I play sometimes. I play around with my son and stuff and have him on the floor cracking up, you know. But I'm just a poet, and that's all, you know, rap is anyway, is poetry. I mean, the good rap anyway is, you know, just poetry to music. But, you know, I'm just a poet by heart, And, you know, my uncle, George Clinton, you know, he was a poet. You know, a lot of his songs, if you really listen, you hear a whole lot of poetry. So it's probably in the family. It's probably an innate quality or something.
You know, do you have something that you can share with our listening audience real quickly, a poet or a poem?
Oh, I was not prepared for that. okay, let me see. I'm so scared because I wasn't prepared. Okay, once I was a really bad man, and when death came to me, I came across a city of bones, and a serpent said with glee, "Make this city your home. The place of paradise you wish to see isn't going to be for you or me. See, I thought I was a good person inside. Turns out to myself I had lied." That's a short one.
And that's that piece. All right, that's what we should say on our open mic segment of the show. See, you were more prepared than you thought. You came out with that, and it flowed perfectly.
But you know what? I keep that one in the front of my head, so whenever I speak to the youth, I usually say that one. So that's why that one came kind of quick. But, you know, I love to say that one because that one, it came from a dream. You know, I dreamed one time that I was walking, and I had two rooms. I could go this way and go in this room, that one. And so I just decided to take. I can't remember which room I went into, but when I went, it was like a bunch of bones and trees, and the trees looked like they were made out of bones and skeletons and everything everywhere. And it was really black, not dark, black. And I was scared to death. It's like the light came from the bones, and then all of a sudden, blazes of fire came up. So I was scared, and I took it as a warning that I had better get a grip or I was going to hell. And it might not have been that, but that's how I took it. And so when I woke up, I was so scared, I just started writing, and I wrote that poem. It just came out. And so, you know, and I tell people the poem because basically it's just talking about a man who thought that he was good, but he was doing some, because he was doing some good things, but he was doing a lot of bad things. And then before you know it, he ended up in hell, you know, and it's too late now to turn back, you know, and when his good and his bad was weighed, he was more evil than he was good. And so now he's with the serpent in hell, and he just has to dwell there. So I usually tell that to the kids, like after I finish talking to them, that's like the last thing that I kind of leave them with.
Oh, okay. You kind of brought me explaining that to me, that poem to me. I kind of was drawn into the poem itself. You helped me to see that poem actually come into life. So that was beautifully done.
Oh, thank you. And they always ask me to say it twice. They always ask me to say it twice. The students will tell me, and then the teachers, if it's a school or whatever, teachers say, wait a minute, do that again, say it one more time. And it's short, so I don't mind it. And I'm trying to do that because I found that with kids, their attention span, even teenagers, their attention span is not like it used to be. Like I've had,
absolutely,
you know, poets that used to, you know, go, remember how Nipsey Russell used to, you know, get up there and start that rhyming, and you'd be so caught up, you'd say, oh, you know, not today, you better make that sucker short and sweet, because they will miss it. They will miss the point. They'll start daydreaming, you know, wanting to go on the playground or wanting to go hang out, you know. So I try to keep it short and sweet. And sometimes a short poem like what I just wrote, it sounds like a lot, but on paper it's really not. It's just like, I think, two or three stanzas. But I try to, you know, keep it short and sweet so this way they can, you know, get it. And I'll write it, and then I'll spend about maybe an hour or two just kind of fixing it and making sure that the words are proper and getting the understanding across, that I don't lose, you know, what I needed, you know, need to come out of it, you know.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the screenwriting and the filmmaking day. You know, you went to school for film and journalism.
Mm-hmm.
What made you want to get into screenwriting and filmmaking?
Well, you know, when my grandmother is a teacher, she was the director of the Write to Read program, and she always, like, pushed reading, because our family, on my mother's side, they are teachers going back to, like, just after slavery. And so, and it's like we have a whole Bible where we can, like, track it. And, you know, so she really believed in reading and writing. And so, you know, she started me off to writing, and the first thing I wrote was a play. And so the plays were really my first love, because you got to write what the character's going to say, where he's going to stand, where he's going to move, you know, what he's going to do. And so from there, I began to like writing movies. And so, you know, I would do the same, but I would envision, I didn't know the format, of course, I was young, but I would envision it being a movie, you know, so I began writing those. And so when I got older, you know, of course, now you're talking poetry, fictional stories, plays, and then doing the screenplays, again, even though I didn't know the proper format. And so I grew up writing all of them and just kind of keeping them and saving them. And, you know, so what I'm doing now, or what I'm trying to do now as far as, like, the filmmaking, it just kind of all fell into place, you know. And I want to say something, because some people, like, I know some people will say, well, good Lord, you're all over the place. And when I explain this, they understand why. They understand why. Because in 2002, I was struck with lupus. I was actually in 2002, they didn't know what was wrong with me. And then finally, the test showed it in 2003 that I had lupus. And so, you know, afraid that, you know, I might die tomorrow, I just kind of looked at myself and I said, you know, you got trunks of stories that you started and suitcases and little storage bins of notebooks of stories that you wrote, and you've done nothing with them. I had nothing to show for it, because writing for myself was fulfilling. I mean, I was good with that. But I did always know that I was going to, you know, try to get with a big publisher, and I wanted to be the Black Daniel Steele. You know, I really wanted those big fat checks. You know, I wanted the publisher to know that. Really, I wanted them to know that, you know, I am the bomb writer. Like, you know, this is what's always in my head, but I hadn't done a whole lot about it, because, you know, when you have a family, you got to work. And I was in human resources in the corporate world, and I had to take care of my family, and I was making nice money, you know. So that's the direction that I took, but at the same time, it wasn't, you know, fulfilling. And then when I was diagnosed with the lupus, it was like, what do you have to show aside from, you know, the money that you've made and so on and so forth? The thing that you really wanted to do, you've never done. So the minute that they diagnosed me with lupus, of course, they gave me the medicine for lupus, and it kind of brought me right up out of it. And, you know, I began to feel like myself. I was able to get out of bed, because prior to that, for months, I wasn't able to walk or do anything, you know. And so once they, you know, began to give me the medicine, you know, I bounced right back. And the first thing I did, actually, my fever was so high one time that I began writing a story titled When It All Went Down. And that was like where the government had done something to the world. We never know what, but we know the effects of it, where it's so foggy and misty and cloudy outside that you can't see no more than a couple of feet in front of you. And so people had to go, like, underground just to try to live for shelter from the weather and so on and so forth. And so I ended up...
I commend you because, you know what, a lot of times when people get news that's not favorable to them, and you have a sickness that you're battling with, a lot of people would have given up.
Yeah.
But I commend you because you're still going. You're still going after the things that you aspire to be or the things that you're already doing. So, you know, I applaud you very much, because you are really, you know, making a statement, making your mark, and moving forward in your life in spite of your circumstances. So very, very, very commendable.
And I'm trying. It's hard, though. It really is. It's hard. You know, my mother supports me. She's my manager, Gwen Hicks. She's my manager, and she acts as my publicist and marketer for now, you know, until we can, you know, get someone that we can trust. We've had a few, but you know how that goes. You know, until you get the right person, you know, they all flop
the
nighter. I'm sorry.
Nothing wrong with that. I said there's nothing wrong with keeping it in the family, you know, to get inside something different.
Yeah, well, she'll probably always be my manager.
I know she'll be glad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, she, you know what, the thing is, you know, for both of us, it's been, life has been a tour, because my stepfather died in 92. My brother was killed or murdered in 95 or 96, I believe it was. And so, and it was like hard on all of us, you know, especially my mother. She lost her husband and she lost her son. And then, you know, we just lost other relatives, grandmothers, cousins, you know, and so it was kind of rough. And my mother had always gotten a hobby, and her hobby was always like a part-time job. And I think that kind of kept her busy. And so the fact that she's my manager, I love it, because not only is does she have my best interests at heart and she's backing me and supporting me in so many ways, but, you know, it also is giving her, you know, something to do. And I love that, because the two of us really, believe me when I tell you, we humping every day, even on Sundays, you know, trying to make it happen.
That's so important. You know, to have a strong support team, someone standing behind you, and you both, you know, are being an anchor for one another. And so, that's a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of address your organization, People Helping People. You know what? I absolutely love that, because I do life coaching, and I have my company name is Nia Happy, but the letters for Happy stands for Helping All Push Past Yield. And so when I saw this in your bio, I said, I really, really want to ask her about that, because there are so many people that walk the face of the earth who don't walk in their purpose. But I think that all of us have a purpose to help someone else. So when I find other people that are actually doing that, I find it very intriguing, and I want to know what made you come up with this organization for helping other people?
Well, I worked at Rutgers, and I was at Rutgers. I was a job placement coordinator, and I'm also a part-time manager at another site. And basically what we did, it was around the time of Clinton, and around, 1994, I think it was, or 95. And what we used to do was we used to help people in the welfare to work program to find work. And then we would help the people who were on unemployment to find jobs. And with that, it was not just helping them to find work and jobs. It was counseling. And we knew it was, but we didn't realize the extent until a lot of the people on unemployment were depressed and they were upset because it had been about a year or almost a year and unemployment was going to be up and, you know, they needed to work because, you know, a lot of them were making nice money. And that was the main reason why the companies let them go, because that was the best, fastest, and easiest way to cut costs, you know. And so, you know, they were depressed because a lot of them had their jobs for like 20 and 30 years, you know, and they were still young, you know. And so we had to get in there and counsel them and, you know, give them some kind of direction or just make them feel at ease, you know, because the job search was not easy. And then those who were on welfare, they didn't know where they wanted to go. A lot of them were third generation, you know, or maybe longer welfare recipients. And so, you know, they didn't know what they wanted to do. It was just like all of a sudden one day somebody put a little ejection button under their butts and pushed it, you know, and said, get up, do something. So they were sending them to us and saying, okay, well, we got some, you know, students. And then they would say, like, what programs do you have? And, you know, what would happen is they would go there and get the training, and then they would come to me for the placement. But there were always those who, you know, didn't know what they wanted to do. And so they had began to send them to me, because in order for me to help them find a job, I had to talk to them, and I ended up helping them, you know, and sometimes not even in our program, but directing them to a better program that was better for them. So, you know, it was very it touched me to be able to do that. And that was my calling, and I didn't even know it. I thought I was a corporate person. I knew I had the writing in me, but I just thought, you know, I'm about the money, you know. And when I started, really, I really did. And then when I started helping people, it was, and it may sound crazy to some people because, you know, we like our cars and our TVs and electronics and everything, but I never felt as good with money as I did helping people. And so that really touched me. But then, of course, you know, I was getting paid nicely, but I wasn't getting benefits, so I had to leave there. And, you know, I felt really depressed, and I didn't know why. Like, you know, why am I feeling so kind of down? But it was because I wasn't helping people. So that's when I realized it, and I decided to do People Helping People. And the fact that the problem was that I wasn't helping people just helped me to pick out the name. So that's how that all came about.
Wow, I am so impressed with what you just said. And I'm trying not to become emotional and keep it all together, but, you know, that's the thing that's after my own heart. I think that I used to work in a corporate environment as well, and it isn't as fulfilling to you when you're making all this good money and you're not you're not helping anybody else. It just seems like your existence is fruitless.
Mm-hmm.
So I know exactly how you feel. You know, you have all these wonderful things, nice cars, nice houses, and things, but yet, you know, I go down the street and I see somebody lying on the street, homeless, no place
yeah.
to go. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I have more than enough to help them. And, you know, that should bother you in some
yeah.
aspect of your life. And so, you know, I found myself in that position. And it brings you to a different reality. And you have to make some adjustments in your life. And, you know, everybody may not see that in their lives, but
mm-hmm.
when it hits you, that means that you're supposed to be readjusting your life and following after your calling.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't answer that call because they feel like, you know, if I could do it for myself, they can do it too. And
yeah.
that statement could be very true. But if you're in a position where you are chosen or called to help other people, that to me is so much more rewarding.
Yeah.
And it's just hard to really put all of that into words, but, you know, I know exactly how you feel with coming up with this organization. I want to talk to you a little bit about you have so much going on. It just excites me to even just talk about it.
I make the interview easy, huh?
yes. I love the fact that you are editor-in-chief of Amistad newspaper, and there's a separate publication. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, actually, Amistad started out as a newspaper, and I joined their team. They were actually a newsletter, and then when I joined, it became a newspaper. And because I had a lot of experience and knowledge, you know, one of my degrees is in journalism, and so I brought a lot to the table. And, you know, when I told them, you know, the cost and, you know, of doing a newsletter is actually more expensive than the cost of doing a newspaper, and I brought a lot of things to their attention, then we, you know, did a trial run, and they liked it, and so we continued. And then one of the people who was editor-in-chief, she left after a few months. And so me being the other person was a business manager, but I was the person who knew everything else. So I ended up becoming editor-in-chief, and that's the way it was. So, and then now, you know, they kind of like, you know, everybody went in their own direction. So now I'm kind of like, you know, keeping it alive. I took a year or so off, or maybe a little longer than that, just to focus on the publishing company and the books. And so now what we're going to do, I'm thinking about giving it a try and to turning Amistad into a magazine. So I'm not sure if I want to do that because I just feel so two-faced leaving the newspaper. Like, I get so emotional. And it's crazy because the magazine would be so much easier to lay out, to, you know, get it together, and probably even a little more sophisticated because, you know, if I went to a Queen Latifah or someone and said I'm with Amistad Magazine, you know, they would probably, you know, jump to do the interview. But if I say I'm with Amistad Newspaper, you know, it sounds like a little community paper. You know, I mean, I'm just thinking about all of these things, but, you know, I don't know. I find it a little – see, the thing is with the news – it's not a world magazine, you know, but it is a world newspaper because I put world news in there, not just, you know, what's local and not just what's national. You know, I had things in there. Remember the big sinkhole in Guatemala that just fell through? And then, I put that in there. The hurricanes, the tsunamis, I mean, all of the craziness, you know, the different wars, I had that in there because the goal of the Amistad newspaper is to make the inner community alert of what's going on around the world. But you can't do that. I mean, granted, I could be like a Time Life magazine or a People magazine, but that's, you know, when I think magazine, I think different. I think celebrities,
yeah.
I think style and fashion, you know, I think like that. I don't think, you know, a big sinkhole went through, you know. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I'm still juggling with that one.
Yeah, well, do you think it's something that you can pass the, you know, the baton to someone else and they can keep that part of it going and you can just
start the magazine?
Yeah.
Oh, I could pass the torch, or I don't know what you mean by pass the torch, but I'll tell you what I mean. I mean, I could hire someone and let them, you know, run it, you know, under my guise to, you know, make the magazine come into fruition and, you know, to make it happen. But I actually have thought about, you know, because I have this little need to do a magazine, I've thought about reaching out to Russell Simmons because, you know, he has Global Grind. And so I've been kind of toying with it, and I've kind of tweeted him a few hints on Twitter. But I won't come strong until I know for sure that I want to, you know, do that because, again, you see, I have a lot going on. But I've toyed with it, you know. But I don't know about the magazine. Best case scenario, I may hire somebody else to run it. I mean, I'll tell them what they need to do, left, right, up, down, and then they'll follow through and make it happen. But I don't think that I could never leave Amistad newspaper. I can't. I mean, even my business partner, and he was the first one on it when it was just a newsletter, even he used to say to me, sis, you are Amistad. And I'm not bragging or anything like that, but I know I have a connection with Amistad. And I just
understand that.
Yeah, that newspaper, I could never, because I mean, literally, and if you want, I'll get your information from you if you email me, and I'll send you a PDF of one of the papers, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, whatever.
Yes,
if it
I would love that.
Yeah, like, for example, remember when Rutgers, they finally won, I don't know what the football terms, but they won the whatever for football. Their team, like, went all the way. And I wrote about the coach. Even though Amistad, you know, it kind of like hints that it's a black newspaper, I put World News in there because World News doesn't have a color. And since, you know, that was the first time Rutgers had won a championship in I don't know how long, you know, I put that in there and it actually made the cover. So I think it did make the cover. No, I think the black coach that won, the black NFL coach whose team won, I put him on the cover. But, you know, so, you know, I just couldn't. I just like to enlighten, you know, the world as to what's going on. Like I used to tell my students in geology and in geography, I cannot imagine living in a world and not knowing where the countries are. Like you should not think that UK or Switzerland is in Asia, and you shouldn't think that Timbuktu is in, you know, Europe. Somewhere. You know, I mean, that bothers me so bad. My students used to say, you and these maps, I can't take it. And one student told me, these maps make me want to have my mother transfer me just because of the maps. I love the school, but the maps are dry. And they knew it, when they at the end of the school year, they all put together this map, the map of the different countries, and gave it to me with glittering stars. And they kind of overdid it, like as if to say I overdid it with all of the maps. But I said, guess what? You will remember where a lot of these things are, believe it or not. I said, but at least you'll be that much smarter, that much wiser.
Absolutely.
As to where everything is. Yeah.
We are. We have 17 more minutes remaining in the show, and I am so enjoying the interview. It's just like a breath of fresh air to have such a wonderful person to interview. And before I go, I want to make sure you get in to share your information about where to get your book, where to connect with you at, and then we'll go back into some more questions.
All right. Well, you can buy the book at Amazon.com. A little update, a lot of authors are going through something with their a lot of self-published authors are going through something with their distributors, and it's actually a problem on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And I'll probably go into that when we talk a little bit more. But because of these issues, you know, everybody's kind of redirecting how they're putting their books out there. So on that note, what I'll say to people, if I have a new cover out on the book, if you want to assure that you get the new cover, you can buy from Cupcake Status, who is the seller on Amazon. Right now, I wouldn't, you know, at least for the next couple of weeks, I wouldn't order from anyone else because you don't know what cover you're going to get. We had an initial cover, and we made it a special edition, but some people want the special edition. Some people want the new cover because the new cover has the girl and the guy, and it looks all sexy or whatever. When they go to buy the new cover, you know, the people have bought the old book, and they're advertising it under our cover. And so when you go to buy the new cover, you end up getting the old, and that's really horrible for business. So we're in the process of stopping all of those people from selling the book on Amazon. I don't even know how they got it. There are people who are selling my book. I have no clue how they got the books. So
well, you know, Amazon has a spot where you can resell, consignment type of situation. So that's
mm-hmm.
A situation that definitely needs to be addressed because many other authors that I know have dealt with the same issue. So, you know, they're working to get all that resolved, I do believe. Now that we've uh, you, giving us your information. I do want to just touch on the your upcoming project or mm-hmm. or with your biography and the screenplay that you're going to do on your uncle, George Clinton, and mm-hmm. The Clinton family. Tell us a little bit about that project.
All right. Well, I've actually talked to George, and he has, because we started in 2002 after George's father had passed away. And I was in Maryland, and we were taking care of his business, and we just began talking, he, I, and my father, and we were talking about documentary, you know, screenplay and all of that. And so we started with gathering information, and we weren't sure at the time which one we're going to do first. So we gathered all the information, and it just seemed obvious that we should do the biography. Since then, you know, he's had a lot going on. I'm sure you saw in the news where, you know, he's fighting, you know, to get his rights for his music. And he's also going before Congress to try to change the way that they do things in the music industry. So, you know, with all of that going on, it looks like, again, it's just obvious that we do the family story. And, you know, by the time all that's said and done, then we'll, you know, come to the table and see what, you know, what direction we're going to go in next. So for now, I'm working on the biography. I haven't actually began going back to the table because I have actually a lot. I have a lot of information, but I haven't gone to the table with it as yet because I'm, you know, dealing with the publishing company and dealing with the book. And I have two more books coming out in the fall, God willing. But that is what's on the table now, to work on the biography. And the biography is of his life. It's about, you know, a lot of people have come to my father, who's his brother, who's George's brother, and they've asked, like, you know, he is, like, so way out, and he's just so, you know, psychedelic, you know, like, what made him get like that, especially since he's come from doo-wop? Like, yeah, they're really curious because they're like, how do you go from doo-wop to that, you know? And so he, you know, my father's always trying to explain to them different things. So we got to talking, and I said, you know, why don't we just do it that way? Why don't we take that angle where we incorporate a lot of his life as a child and growing up and what you guys went through, saw, you know, because they lived in Newark, New Jersey. So you're talking, you know, they were around the times of the riots and prior, you know, with the racial prejudices, you know, with the different gangs, be it the Italian or the Hispanic or the blacks, and, you know, just the whole thing of growing up in Newark and what he's seen and how it's affected him and, you know, what he was trying to get away from, because he had been in the music business for a very long time before his first hit, but he was determined that he was going to be successful in this music business. And so there's like a huge story to tell, and sometimes in some biographies or autobiographies or life stories, it's not all captured. So we said, why don't we start there and capture everything, not just the typical going through when they're first born and then shooting on up to the glory days. Why don't we capture everything that made George? And so we agreed that that's where we're going to start. And so, you know, that's what this book is going to be about. It's about George Clinton and his family.
You know, I would love to actually be there to support you guys. That sounds very interesting.
Oh, please do.
You always want to... story behind the talent or the person, you know, especially a lot of celebrities, you're right, the entire story is not always mm-hmm. captured, but since there's the family actually putting this together,
mm-hmm.
it's just so much more that's going to be included. So
yeah, because
I'm so looking.
The thing is it'll capture what makes George. And like, even with Ray, like, we just know that, and I'm not knocking the movie Ray because it was brilliant and I really love it, but what I'm saying is that we wanted more. This is Ray Charles you're talking about, and what you got was the beginning, the middle, the end, and that's how a lot of the movies are, and that's why, like, as a writer, I tell people, you know, when you're going to write, you need to decide whether or not it is a movie or whether it is a regular TV show, or if it's a series, or if it's an HBO series, because there's a difference, you know, and not just HBO, but HBO Showtime and some of the premium channel, you know, if it's worthy of those channels, because, like, even with the book that I have now, Life Knows No Bounds, I'm going to be, actually, I have a producer out now And I'm looking and talking to a couple more who have some connections, because I want to pitch that to be an HBO or Showtime series, because a movie will not do it justice. And I've heard that from so many people that I had to sit back and, like, think about it. They all said, you know, if you do that book as a movie, they're not going to capture the essence of Omar, because he has a deep, dark, like, story. And they said, you're not going to catch the greed of Elisa, the main character. You know, so, and I thought about it. When you look at the Wire and you look at Sopranos and some of those other channels, even some of the ones on Showtime, you know, you really see the elongated version of their lives and who they are. You know, Omar from The Wire, you don't just get that he was a killer and a murderer. You really get a lot of things, like his grandmother going to church and he went with her that time, and then the uncle who kind of like has one foot on the good side, one foot on the bad, so you can kind of see why it was easy for Omar to slip. Like, you get some background and you get a lot more. So, you know, with the, that's the same thing we did with the book, and the same thing that we were thinking about with, you know, with my uncle's story. So which direction we're going to take it when we turn the biography into something on the screen, we don't know. But for sure, we do know that we want to capture, like, what made George George. And it's not going to be just that he met some guys and they made some music. It's some things before that. Because when nobody was directing him, and of course I'm not gloating or anything, but nobody was directing him across that stage how to stand, how to dance, how to talk, how to, you know, throw his head back and make them bird calls and dog sounds and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, all of this stuff is something that's George, you know? And you want to know what got him. Like, a lot of people, you know, sometimes they'll knock Jersey. Oh, you know, this is just Jersey or whatever. But, you know, he was from Jersey. Frank Sinatra was from Jersey. Queen Latifah, Dionne Warwick, Whitney Houston. You know, we got a lot of stuff going on in Jersey. And it's good. Okay. And it's making entertainment history. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, when you find out about him growing up and the era and the time and the things that are going on, you get the inside scoop on who's George or what made George George. You know, so that's what we're trying to do.
Do you guys have an anticipated date that, you know, we should expect this, or is it still in the making?
Well, as far as the biography, I'm shooting for 2012, but realistically, probably 2013. And again, anything can happen, but just looking at the time frame that I have for other things, realistically, 2013. Because don't get me wrong, I have all the data. I actually had started doing the screenplay around, I think, 2003, 2004. And the information that I put there is the information that's going to go in the book, and then some, of course. So I have the data. I mean, there's some more that I want to get to kind of, like, you know, fill in the Swiss cheese holes, you know. But for the most part, we have all the information. It's just a matter of just kind of laying it all out, you know. And I'm not even sure about whether I want to put it in chronological order. Of course, you want to put it, for the most part, in chronological order. But then sometimes, even in doing that, you reach a certain part in where something happened in his life where you have to talk about something else that happened in his life. And you may not have mentioned it earlier because that's not the direction. So it's a lot of planning and plotting and laying it out and, you know, spreading it all out and piecing it together and everything that has to be done. So as much as people are pushing me to make this happen in 2012, I will. But honestly, I think it'll be maybe spring 2013, God willing.
Wow. You definitely have your hands full. And again, I am so honored that you have come on to the Poetic Energy Radio Show, and It's just a truly an honor just to have learned so much about what you are doing, your future plans, your current plans, and you're a very impressive person. It's just, you know, my heart is filled with joy just to, you know, have a connection with you through this interview. We have 6 more minutes remaining in the show, and I just wanted you to, just with parting words, what would you say to a person who aspires to be walking in your shoes? What would you say to that person to encourage them to move forward, even with all the things that you have gone through, the tragedies, the ups and downs, the news of your illness? What would you say to a person who wants to be where you are?
Well, to those who are older, like my age or maybe a little younger, but just older and mature, I would say time is of the essence. So, you know, to sit and kind of like plot out, well, first lay out all the things you want to do and then kind of plot out, you know, the timeline in which you want to do these things and really go for it. I'm talking when I decided that I couldn't choose whether or not I wanted to get my degree in English or film, and my grandmother was pushing me to go for English because she said, you know, you don't know about film, it's tricky, you know, but see, she was a teacher, so she knew about English. So I ended up doing both, and because I didn't want to just get it in English, I wanted to get it in English and film. I had to climb, like, hills, deep hills to go to class in the rain, in the snow, slipping, breaking my behind and my ankles, you know what I'm saying, doing whatever. Ever to make sure that I got up in there and I got my degree. And so, you know, once you kind of like spread it all out, that what you want to do, and you kind of put it into some kind of an order, follow through and don't let anything or anyone come in between it. You know, true friends and loved ones, they'll understand, you know, that you're not getting brand new. You just have to, you know, handle your business, you know, and so you just go for it. And for those who are young, I would tell them, you know, one of the mistakes that I made was I put the cart before the horse. My grandmother used to say to me, you know, get your education first, and then, you know, once you've been established, then start enjoying, you know, the fruits of your labor. And, you know, being young and silly, I said, I want to live now. You know, I want to have fun now. And after long debate, she just kind of said, okay, you'll see. And sure enough, I did, because I ended up married and having kids, and then it was that much harder to get my degree. So I would tell anyone, you know, this is what your youthful days are for. You know, when you start out going to pre-K and kindergarten and first grade and elementary and middle school and high school, you know, there's a system, there's a situation going here. You're not just getting up every morning and going to school. Each time you go, it's an investment in your life. So you follow this and you follow the trend. You learn from the people who were there before you. Don't try to reinvent the wheel, because it's just going to get you there that much later. You know, just go ahead and, you know, focus on what it is that you want to be. Do everything you need to be it, and, you know, be able to be one of those few who sit back and say, I'm glad I went and I did it, because now look what I have, as opposed to those who say, I got to try to play catch up because I wasted so many years. You know, so I would give those two pieces of advice to, you know, those who, you know, have dreams of being a writer or getting into film, et cetera.
With that being said, I could tell you love encouraging people, because you said a whole lot. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I just want to take the time. One of the guests in the chat room wants to know how they connect with you. I did put your Facebook information in earlier, but can you tell people over the airwaves, because I know people will be checking it out in the archives, on how they can connect with you, if you have your Facebook or website, or tell them that information again.
Well, I've become a Twitter junkie, so I would tell people, and I have my Twitter connected to my Facebook, so I can share both of whatever I'm going through at the same time. So with Twitter, I am, what am I? I'm T. Clinton. At Twitter, I'm TEACLINTON13. That's T. Clinton 13. And on Facebook, I'm author Andrea Clinton. And my email is aroundthewaypub@aol.com, and my screen name is Around the Way Pub, or my IM on AOL. And I guess that's the best way to get to me, either to email me. Actually, you get to me faster by Twitter. I told you I'm a Twitter junkie. I'm going to tweet as soon as I hang up. So really, and I'm actually trying to build. I haven't figured out. I mean, I'm getting people, you know, I'll say something funny or I'll say something and I get 2 and 3 people. I haven't figured out how somebody like TV1, I know they're bigger, but I haven't figured out how they get like 300, 400, 500 people in a day. I haven't gotten that concept yet, so. But, yeah, just, you know, follow me and then, you know, send it forward to everybody else that you know to follow me, and I would definitely appreciate that.
I definitely sure will. We have one more minute remaining. I just wanted to thank all of the people who tuned in and chimed in and signed into the chat room. We definitely appreciate you hanging out with us on the Poetic Energy Radio Show. We'd like to thank you, Andrea, so much for being a very special guest on the Poetic Energy Radio Show. Please do come back again.
I definitely will.
We are very honored. We are definitely honored to have had you on the show. We would definitely connect with you. We want to remind people her book is Life Knows No Bounds, one who loves you more. And she mentioned the information earlier of how to purchase that book. And please connect with her on Facebook. And we want to say thank everyone once again for hanging out with us on the Poetic Energy Radio Show. Everyone, please do have a great and safe holiday and a great evening. Good night, all.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea.
All right. Email me.
Bye-bye. I sure will.
All right.